Now that the total 2024 solar eclipse is over, it's time to talk about meteors. Meteors is a metaphor that we at Directions on Microsoft use, and we've been using over the past few years, to describe trends around Microsoft's implementation of products and licensing. Like a meteor, these trends can appear in the distance, heat up due to friction, and come crashing down unexpectedly on your data center if you're not paying attention. Welcome to the Directions on Microsoft Briefing podcast. I'm Mary Jo Foley, the editor-in-chief here at Directions. And as you may guess, we're talking about meteors today, and my special guest for this episode is Directions analyst Josh Troopen. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you so much. That was the most dramatic description of licensing that I think I've ever heard.
I think I gotta somehow trademark that. I don't know. Or you probably already have, since you're the meteor and chief guy, I hear.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm torn between saying I'm excited to be here and kind of having that glum, don't look up feeling.
Right.
when we put these pieces together and try to warn people about these trends, you know, just years in advance.
Right.
And we can't even say that we're Cassandras anymore because Apache kind of stole that for a database system.
Yeah, they did. Well, before we get going, I want to tell people here about Josh. Before he came to Directions on Microsoft, he spent more than 19 years at Microsoft, where he guided coverage of developer and IT topics as the executive editor of MSDN Magazine and TechNet Magazine. And more recently, he consulted with Fortune 500 companies as application development manager with Microsoft Premier Developer. Okay, Josh, let's start out by having you walk us through the three waves of meteors that you've been tracking in the Windows and Office space.
Sure, absolutely. The first time we really came up with this concept and saw the first wave of Microsoft product and licensing meteors approaching us, I believe it was 2018. We charted various product support and interoperability features and retirements, and basically we saw that there would be a series of products that Microsoft would either take off the board or limit the versions of Windows they work with. And that would eventually compel all customers to move to Windows 10 to remain compliant, even if they purchase one seat of Exchange Server. Mm-hmm. That would trigger this meteor shower that would end up forcing the entire organization to Windows 10. Hmm. We're watching the second wave of meteors kind of come down right now. In a nutshell, Microsoft, between now and 2025 and 2026, they appear to be compelling customers to make the final move off on-premises, or what we actually call perpetually licensed software, where you buy it once and then you can use it forever, mm-hmm. in favor of subscription versions of the same software, like SharePoint Server. Mm-hmm. Now, the third wave, which is noticeable to me because I cover Power Platform, is the attempts to move a lot of different features and services to Azure billing instead of paying per user monthly licenses. Mm. This is mostly voluntary right now, but there are a few elements of it that we're going to be watching very closely to see if two data points become a trend line.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that sounds interesting. You've got my hackles raised. But before we go there, let's drill down more on the second wave, because that's rapidly approaching. I know that over the next couple of years, Windows and Office products are not going to be supported anymore by Microsoft. So I'm curious, what are you telling customers they should do about this just over a year out from some of these deadlines?
Well, here we are in 2024, and in short, what we're seeing is there is going to be a series of these on-premises software suites that will leave support between now and 2026. Mm-hmm. And this leaves a lot of common enterprise deployments unsupported. And this leads to two issues when you're running unsupported software. First, Microsoft support, and believe me, because I was part of it for the better part of a decade, they will not touch any issues that arise in a customer's enterprise unless the customer upgrades to a supported version, if not the latest version, of all the software involved. Mm-hmm. But also, Microsoft usually will not touch the source code or issue updates of any software that is out of lifecycle. Mm-hmm. So you run daily the increased risk of becoming an attack vector. And that's especially true for companies without adequate security protections in place. By my informal surveys, that amounts to basically 100% of everyone. So we've seen this every few years in the past. And, you know, Microsoft's on-premises software is released on a 2 or 3 year cadence. So you get Office 2013, 2016, 2019, 2021. And that's unlike their subscription products stuff like Microsoft 365, which will come out on a weekly or a monthly, or if you play your cards right, you might be able to stay on a version for maybe a year. Mm-hmm. But what's different this time is that companies have a lot of reasons for staying on these long-term on-premises additions that they already have paid for.
Right.
You know, they have line of business processes that they run well right now. There's no reason to take on additional expense. They know that all their other purchased software is compatible with what they're running. But unfortunately, and maybe fortunately for Microsoft, the options to continue running perpetually licensed software on-premises will intentionally become increasingly restrictive. Microsoft's focus, of course, is cloud-first subscriptions. That suits their best interests. They can do things like slipstream new features or restrictions in. They can get rid of features that are more nuisance than benefit to them. But most importantly, their balance sheets want to show steady monthly user growth. And Microsoft has left behind the old 3 year software cycle spike that used to make their balance sheet look more wobbly. They would rather just have slow, steady monthly growth by selling, right, user licenses.
Right. Yeah, I feel like next October 2025 is going to be like a watershed time, right? I know Windows 10's exiting support, a bunch of the Office products are exiting support around that time, yeah, too. And that, I feel like if people aren't already prepping for that now, they really need to be, because that's not really, yeah, that far away, right?
Right. And even the stuff that is not leaving support on its own, there will be unsupported scenarios like, mm-hmm, running certain on-premises versions of Office on certain versions of Windows Server, for instance. They are both under warranty, as it were. They were both under product support, not end of life, but they're simply not compatible with one another.
Right.
So you have to watch that as well, obviously.
Yeah, good point. Also, let's talk about Exchange Server and Skype for Business Server and what's going to happen with these going forward. So I remember, I think it was 2021 or so, Microsoft was like, yep, we're going to do on-premises updates for all our big servers, Exchange and SharePoint and Skype for Business. And then the only one that really materialized was SharePoint.
Right.
So I'm curious, what is going to happen with Exchange? I know they've said there will be a new version of Exchange in 2025, but we've heard absolutely nothing about that since a couple of years, right, ago. And Skype for Business Server, I don't even know what to say there, because we've asked Microsoft for updates on that a few times, and the answers we've gotten have been very, I don't know what I would say, squirrely, maybe?
Right, not determinative.
Right.
It almost feels like they've kind of forgot about Exchange and Skype and kind of put them down a memory hole somewhere. Mm-hmm. So we were, waiting and waiting for the Exchange v Next announcements here, and they mentioned a little bit about it. And, you know, in a way, I understand how they're justifying the delays. And it's been almost 2 years now. Back in 2022, Microsoft announced that the problem with Exchange, why it's slow coming out, is due to state-sponsored threats against on-premises Exchange servers. So great, you know, happy they're taking this seriously. This is, you know, without exaggeration, we could lose the entire internet thanks to malicious attacks like this.
That's true.
But, you know, then I started to think about this. This is the biggest problem and the driving force behind their delays. Wouldn't it make the most sense to Microsoft and to the world, basically, to take Exchange 2019 and target nothing but that one security element immediately? And I know it's been 5 years since its release and it's leaving mainstream and everything, but you know, malicious actors around the globe now seem to be a far bigger threat than losing face because we extended mainstream support for a bit. And the worst thing you can do with these known threats is to say, well, we're looking at it, catch you in 2025.
Yeah, no kidding. So let's talk Windows, one of my favorite topics. I know we've heard on the client side that Microsoft has said there will be extended security updates, ESUs, available for Windows 10 for 3 years starting in 2025. I wasn't that surprised by this because so many people are still running Windows 10. Do you think there'll be something similar like that for Office apps? And I'm also curious if you think customers should be thinking about moving to the recently announced Office 2024 LTSC release. It's supposed to be out later this year.
Sure. I mean, we've been looking at ESUs since they were first released. And in a lot of ways, they don't really seem to be a great purchase in most scenarios. The reason being, they don't actually promise that much.
Right.
They don't change your upgrade rights. Their cost escalates from year to year as an additional incentive, from a negative incentive from Microsoft to get off the version. And they've also kind of given ESUs a, well, we may drop in an urgent update if we feel like it kind of vibe. Right. I absolutely do not see Microsoft issuing any grace period for Office perpetual license suites. Now, I'm saying this for a few reasons. First of all, they haven't really had any history of Microsoft doing this for user software, mostly for server products. Windows 10 will stand out in this already a little bit. But you know, second, as you mentioned, Office 2024 LTSC is coming out. And this makes more sense than paying to keep Office 2019 around or 2021 around. But third, when you look at the whole meteor, you have to remember Microsoft's goal here appears to be to do away with all perpetual licenses and move everyone to subscriptions. And as part of that, you need Microsoft 365 so that they can also compel you to purchase a whole big raft of security and compliance add-ons. And in many people are saying, I wouldn't say this, but many people are saying that a lot of these add-ons supplement what should be in the subscription box in the first place.
Right.
And we're seeing this more and more, and it's wild. This whole batteries not included approach to subscription software while eliminating on-premises software is something that Wes and Rob address a lot in our licensing boot camps as well.
All right. Hey, thanks for the great segue, because I'm going to take a break now. Nice work. I do want to talk about what you just mentioned, our world-famous Microsoft licensing boot camps. So I'm curious, if you're listening to this, have you ever attended one of these, either in person or virtually? If you haven't, there's an in-person one coming up in May, May 21st to 23rd in Atlanta. I got to go to the Atlanta boot camp last year when I was a newbie at Directions. And I have to say, I did feel like the quantity and the quality of information that was presented was impressive, if not almost overwhelming. Plus, you get the opportunity to talk with Directions analysts and other customers one-on-one in small groups. And that really is what makes this a great event. If you are a newbie to Microsoft licensing or you need to get up to speed on the latest twists and turns, this is how you do it. You come to a licensing boot camp. We've got many boot camps throughout the year. There's going to be another in-person one in September in Bellevue if you can't make the Atlanta one in May. And there are a bunch of virtual ones in between. If you want to learn more, go to directionsonmicrosoft.com or you can email info@directionsonmicrosoft.com to learn more about the boot camps as well as our EA advisory and other services that we offer. Okay, back to Josh and his astronomical world of warnings.
I'm back.
You're back. Okay, Microsoft has given us a glimpse, maybe, about how they are trying to wean more organizations off on-premises software in terms of what they did with SharePoint. They came out with something called SharePoint Server Subscription Edition, which is an on-premises release of SharePoint Server, but it requires you to buy an accompanying subscription license in order to get fixes and security updates. And you have to get that add-on license. It's not optional. So I'm curious, Josh, do you think you'll see Microsoft design more of its on-premises servers to require an accompanying subscription like this?
Yeah, I think that SharePoint Server SE really started to give the game away with regards to Microsoft's plans for the future of on-premises. Like you said, SE is Microsoft saying, here you go, you keep bugging us for on-premises servers, we're going to make it exactly as unpleasant as just getting the cloud-hosted subscription. And so starting in 2016, Microsoft has pretty much built a single code base for SharePoint, and they just ship all the bits and updates to the on-premises version, and then they can just flip a switch to turn on all the next version features when they're already on your servers, when it's ready. And they're not even sending you all new software anymore. It's, you know, incremental. Most of it's based on their hosted version with certain useful things disabled. But now they're actually going a step further than that. And they're letting customers know that even if they want the sort of kind of degraded version so they can run it on premises, they're not going to get any technical advantage. They're going to be responsible for their own infrastructure. They can't even count on self-maintaining it after it goes out of support, like older versions of SharePoint Server. Mm-hmm. If you take the new on-premises SharePoint Server, you're getting less, you're paying more, you're not getting it for as long. You will continue to need to pay for the subscription just to use the software that you would previously have had perpetual rights to. So, yeah, here I'd say that they're really designing these server products and releases and licensing to actively discourage customers from purchasing them and to push them to their hosted subscription versions.
Yeah, as you were describing this, I'm like, doesn't sound like something very compelling to buy based on all the criteria you're laying out.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk Meteor number three. I've been dying to talk about this one.
Yes.
The growing prevalence of pay-as-you-go plans, especially, but not uniquely, in the Power Platform service space. So let's talk a little bit about the cons of pay-as-you-go and the pros, if you think there are many or even any.
Absolutely. Time to pay as you go here. So, as you mentioned, most of the Power Platform offerings, which in particular Power Automate, Pages, and Power Apps, have introduced some form of pay as you go billing. Mm-hmm. One of the things we talk repeatedly about around the halls of direction is how we used to think that moving to this per-user subscription licensing plan for everything, we're going to make things so easy that no one would have questions for us anymore. So now we fast forward to 2024. Power Platform has 7 build elements, and each one has a different standard billing scheme and a different pay-as-you-go scheme. Oof. So I just look at the chart and cry. For example, Power Apps has monthly per-user standard billing. They don't offer a per-app plan that would let unlimited users access a single app. if you're doing like a shopping mall kiosk or something. Power Automate, on the other hand, has both a per user plan and a per flow plan. Lets you license a single workflow for unlimited use without per user licenses. And the issue here is we've spoken with customers who want to know how they can just write a kiosk app with Power Apps. And the answer is you can't. There's no way to write something that is compliant with unlimited users on a single app. But meanwhile, on top of this, they've introduced completely optional pay-as-you-go plans for these products completely differently. Now, for Power Apps, they have pay-as-you-go per user rights. So you can, instead of paying for everyone in advance, you can just pay as users show up within your organization. And you only have to pay twice the price of the standard single app access license to get the pay-as-you-go licenses. Now, Power Automate, on the other hand, they don't do anything with pay-as-you-go per-user rights. They will literally bill flows based on each workflow run if you have it marked as pay-as-you-go. So, it can make sense in some limited situations. Maybe you have a workflow that pulls in monthly reports and does an ETL operation once a month, but both of these are using completely different consumption meters. And that's really both the pro and the con in a single example. You can use pay-as-you-go to meter more granularly and accurately. You can figure out actual usage. You don't have to pay for everyone who might touch your app when they don't need to be. But the con is that every pay-as-you-go plan is up to twice as expensive as the corresponding per user plan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So beyond money, since it's twice as expensive, what does Microsoft get out of trying to get more customers to go to pay as you go?
Well, we have to look at it from both ends because we serve customers.
Right.
We don't serve Microsoft here.
No.
as sad as they may be. From the customer's end, of course, Microsoft promotes it as giving you flexibility. But from Microsoft's end, it could also be that they're just trying to prep people slowly, kind of boiling the frogs, to have everything move to Azure billing, which would make their life easier.
Right.
So for customers, it's useful when they're doing a limited rollout of a new line of business app and they want to figure out usage patterns. If you're setting up perhaps an infrequently used flow, maybe like an annual benefit selection site, you could pay for all the users, but just for 2 months in a year. Mm-hmm. Some customers might want to reduce the overhead that they incur by doing license procurement and tracking because it's basically almost on demand on a monthly basis. And some customers really like doing environment itemization and Azure billing. They can charge back each internal budget much more easily by tagging various environments in Azure when the billing comes up.
Okay.
Now, for Microsoft, billing by consumption, I think it more accurately represents their costs to run Azure. Especially if they're doing consumption-based pay-as-you-go. If there are a million per-user licenses floating around out there, they have to kind of guess at what the consumption is going to be each month.
Right.
It could also lower the need in quotes, to audit customers. If you're doing consumption-based work, the usage is just the usage. And we know that Microsoft keeps private telemetry on each Power Platform customer to make sure they're not doing things like sneaking unlicensed users out of the building in their pocket. Microsoft does that. They will frequently go up against customers and say, well, our records show that you're actually using this much. And when the telemetry becomes the actual bill, that gives a lot less wiggle room for customers to kind of shade who gets benefit from a flow or an app. Okay. And of course, you know, Microsoft can also charge more per operation. That goes along with the ability to adjust meters to do things like balancing load against regions, or just, you know, in the end, maybe they just want a bit more money. You know, it's May, they're getting down to the wire. And they are also consolidating billing in one place instead of two. Now, if a customer with a large Azure commitment, Microsoft can almost just hide Power Platform billing under their Azure commitment and make it look almost more like a rounding error, so that there's less pushback to adopting Power Platform, which some of the salespeople are almost certainly getting incentives for. And finally, did I mention that Microsoft makes more money from it?
Yeah, the reason I always ask them, what does Microsoft get out of this question, is because many times it feels like you understand why they're doing something, and then you see where they're kind of going with it next, because you're like, oh, yeah. I see. They want it because of X, so that's why they're going to do Y. So I kind of back into it that way when I think about it.
Yeah, they're sneaky like that.
They are. And we've gotten sneaky to keep up with them, right?
So. Yeah.
All right. So lastly, any other upcoming end of support meteoric dates coming in 2026 or beyond that we really haven't mentioned yet, but you think customers should keep tabs on?
Is this about WordPad being kind of hurts? Well, Microsoft keeps consolidating these end of life dates for software. Which is why, you know, Office 2016 and 2019 both leave support on the same day in October 2025. And, you know, same thing with Windows Server 2016 and 2019, way out in 2029. The whole 5+5 support model, where you get 5 years of mainstream and then 5 years of extended, that is really no more.
Right.
And it's a good time to remind people as well that end of support dates are not the same thing as end of functionality dates, and that Microsoft will not guarantee that all current versions of their software will work with each other, even if they are all under support. So just looking at the Windows and Office chart that we do several times a year to show what works until when, Windows Server 2016 actually has, I believe, 4 end-of-life scenarios. So Server 2016 itself leaves support in January 2027. Yep. It's unsupported after that time. It's not one of these new subscription releases yet, so it may still run okay if you're not touching it. Meanwhile, Office 2016 is supported on Server 2016, but only until the Office 2016 support date hits during the meteor storm in October 2025. And then you look at Office 2019. Even though Office 2016 and 2019, if you look under the covers, they're the same version number, really. I believe it's version 14. Office 2019 is not supported on Server 2016 at all, even while they're both still in product support. And then, yeah, the last thing that I see when I'm looking at the Byzantine charts about who's supported where, right, is Microsoft 365 Apps for Enterprise. They're supported on Server 2016, but only until October 2025, which aligns them with Office 2016 and 2019, even though that's neither of their end-of-life dates. So, yeah. All I can really say is you need to know your software inventory, you need to know who's using what, and then you need to know who's using what together to avoid the worst of these potential meteoric disasters.
Yeah. Wow. That chart just made my head hurt virtually.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Josh. That was really entertaining and enlightening, as usual.
Glad to be here.
To close, I want to remind our listeners they can find lots more coverage of all things Microsoft related on directionsonmicrosoft.com. Thank you for listening. If you have questions, comments, or any topics you'd like to hear the directions analysts cover in one of these podcasts, please do not hesitate to contact me on Twitter/X at Mary Jo Foley. And give us a follow over on Twitter/X at Directions MSFT. That's our consolidated account where we have all the latest Microsoft Enterprise product and licensing information. Thank you very much.
See you later, everyone.